Side 9, The Robots of Dawn. Continuing on page 335. 65. Bailey felt cool air curling about his foot and a sprinkle of cool water. It was a frighteningly abnormal thing to sense, yet he could not allow the door to close, for he would then not know how to open it. How did the robots open those doors? Undoubtedly it was no puzzle to members of the culture, but in his reading on Auroran life, there was no careful instruction of just how one opens the door of a standard airfoil. Everything of importance is taken for granted. You're supposed to know, even though you are, in theory, being informed. He was groping in his pockets as he thought this, and even the pockets were not easy to find. They were not in the right places, and they were sealed, so that they had to be opened by fumbles till he found the precise motion that caused the seal to part. He pulled out a handkerchief, balled it, and placed it between the door and jamb, so that the door would not entirely close. He then removed his foot. Now, to think, if he could. There was no point to keeping the door open unless he meant to get out. Was there, however, any purpose in getting out? If he waited where he was, Giscard would eventually come back for him and presumably lead him to safety. Dare he wait? He did not know how long it would take Giscard to see Daniil to safety and then return. But neither did he know how long it would take the pursuing robots to decide they would not find Daniil and Giscard on any road leading back to the Institute. Surely it was impossible that Daniil and Giscard had actually moved backward toward the Institute in search of sanctuary. Bailey had not actually ordered them not to, but what if that were the only feasible route? No, impossible. Bailey shook his head in silent denial of the possibility and felt it ache in response. He put his hands to it and gritted his teeth. How long would the pursuing robots continue to search before they would decide that Bailey had misled them, or had been himself misled? Would they then return and take him in custody, very politely and with great care not to harm him? Could he hold them off by telling them he would die if exposed to the storm? Would they believe that? Would they call the Institute to report? Surely they would do that. And would human beings then arrive? They would not be overly concerned about his welfare. If Bailey got out of the car and found some hiding place in the surrounding trees, it would be that much harder for the pursuing robots to locate him, and that would gain him time. It would also be harder for Giscard to locate him, but Giscard would be under a much more intense instruction to guard Bailey than the pursuing robots were to find him. The primary task of the former would be to locate Bailey, and of the latter, to locate Daniil. Besides, Giscard was programmed by Fastolf himself, and Amadiro, however skillful, was no match for Fastolf. Surely, then, all things being equal, Giscard would be back before the other robots could possibly be. But would all things be equal? With a faint attempt at cynicism, Bailey thought, I'm worn out and can't really think. I'm merely seizing desperately at whatever will console me. Still, what could he do but play the odds as he conceived the odds to be? He leaned against the door and was out into the open. The handkerchief fell out into the wet, rank grass, and he automatically bent down to pick it up, holding it in his hands as he staggered away from the car. He was overwhelmed by the gusts of rain that soaked his face and hands. After a short while, his wet clothes were clinging to his body, and he was shivering with cold. There was a piercing splitting of the sky, too quick for him to close his eyes against, and then a sharp hammering that stiffened him in terror and made him clap his hands over his ears. Had the storm returned, or did it sound louder only because he was out in the open? He had to move. He had to move away from the car so that the pursuers would not find him too easily. He must not waver and remain in its vicinity, or he might as well have stayed inside and dry. He tried to wipe his face with the handkerchief, but it was as wet as his face was, and he let it go. It was useless. He moved on, hands outstretched. Was there a moon that circled Aurora? He seemed to recall there had been mention of such a thing, and he would have welcomed its light. But what did it matter? Even if it existed and were in the sky now, the clouds would obscure it. He felt something. He could not see what it was, but he knew it to be the rough bark of a tree, undoubtedly a tree. Even a city man would know that much. And then he remembered that lightning might hit trees and might kill people. He could not remember that he had ever read a description of how it felt to be hit by lightning, or if there were any measures to prevent it. He knew of no one on earth who had been hit by lightning. He felt his way about the tree and was in an agony of apprehension and fear. How much was halfway around so that he would end up moving in the same direction? Onward. The underbrush was thick now and hard to get through. It was like bony, clutching fingers holding him. He pulled petulantly and he heard the tearing of cloth. Onward. His teeth were chattering and he was trembling. Another flash, not a bad one. For a moment he caught a glimpse of his surroundings. Trees. a number of them. He was in a grove of trees. Were many trees more dangerous than one tree where lightning was concerned? He didn't know. Would it help if he didn't actually touch a tree? He didn't know that either. Death by lightning simply wasn't a factor in the cities, and the historical novels, and sometimes histories, that mentioned it never went into detail. He looked up at the dark sky and felt the wetness coming down. He wiped at his wet eyes with his wet hands. He stumbled onward, trying to step high. At one point, he splashed through a narrow stream of water, sliding over the pebbles underlaying it. How strange! It made him no wetter than he was. He went on again. The robots would not find him. Would Giscard? He didn't know where he was, or where he was going, or how far he was from anything. If he wanted to return to the car, he couldn't. If he was trying to find himself, he couldn't. And the storm would continue forever, and he would finally dissolve and pour down in a little stream of Bailey, and no one would ever find him again. And his dissolved molecules would float down to the ocean. Was there an ocean on Aurora? Of course there was. It was larger than Earth's, but there was more ice at the Auroran poles. Ah, he would float to the ice and freeze there, glistening in the cold orange sun. His hands were touching a tree again. Wet hands, wet tree, rumble of thunder. Funny he didn't see the flash of lightning. Lightning came first. Was he hit? He didn't feel anything, except the ground. The ground was under him because his fingers were scrabbling into cold mud. He turned his head so he could breathe. It was rather comfortable. He didn't have to walk anymore. He could wait. Giscard would find him. He was suddenly very sure of it. Giscard would have to find him because... No, he had forgotten the because. It was the second time he had forgotten something. Before he went to sleep, was it the same thing he had forgotten each time? The same thing? It didn't matter. It would be all right. All. And he lay there, alone and unconscious, in the rain at the base of a tree, while the storm beat on. Chapter 16. Again Gladia. 66. Afterward, looking back and estimating times, it would appear that Bailey had remained unconscious not less than 10 minutes and not more than 20. At the time, though, it might have been anything from zero to infinity. He was conscious of a voice. He could not hear the words it spoke, just a voice. He puzzled over the fact that it sounded odd and solved the matter to his satisfaction by recognizing it as a woman's voice. There were arms around him, lifting him, heaving him. One arm, his arm, dangled, his head lolled. He tried feebly to straighten out, but nothing happened. The woman's voice again. He opened his eyes wearily. He was aware of being cold and wet and suddenly realized that water was not striking him. And it was not dark, not entirely. There was a dim suffusing of light, and by it he saw a robot's face. He recognized it. Giscard, he whispered. And with that he remembered the storm and the flight. And Giscard had reached him first. He had found him before the other robots had. Bailey thought contentedly, I knew he would. He let his eyes close again and felt himself moving rapidly, but with the slight yet definite unevenness that meant he was being carried by someone who was walking. Then a stop and a slow adjustment until he was resting on something quite warm and comfortable. He knew it was the seat of a car covered perhaps with toweling, but did not question how he knew. Then there was the sensation of smooth motion through the air, and the feeling of soft, absorbent fabric over his face and hands, the tearing open of his blouse, cold air upon his chest, and then the drying and blotting again. After that, the sensations crowded in upon him. He was in an establishment. There were flashes of walls, of illumination, of objects, miscellaneous shapes of furnishings, which he saw now and then when he opened his eyes. He felt his clothes being stripped off methodically and made a few feeble and useless attempts to cooperate. Then he felt warm water and vigorous scrubbing. It went on, and he didn't want it to stop. At one point, a thought occurred to him, and he seized the arm that was holding him. Giscard, Giscard. He heard Giscard's voice. I am here, sir. Giscard, is Daniil safe? He is quite safe, sir. Good. Bailey closed his eyes again, and made no effort whatever in connection with the drying. He felt himself turned over and over in the stream of dry air, and then he was being dressed again in something like a warm robe. Luxury. Nothing like this had happened to him since he was an infant, and he was suddenly sorry for the babies for whom everything was done and who were not sufficiently conscious of it to enjoy it. Or did they? Was the hidden memory of that infant luxury a determinant of adult behavior? Was his own feeling now just an expression of the delight of being an infant again? And he had heard a woman's voice. Mother? No, that couldn't possibly be. Mama? He was sitting in a chair now. He could sense as much, and he could also feel somehow that the short, happy period of renewed infancy was coming to an end. He had to return to the sad world of self-consciousness and self-help. But there had been a woman's voice. What woman? Bailey opened his eyes. Gladia? 67. It was a question, a surprised question, but deep within himself he was not really surprised. Thinking back, he had, of course, recognized her voice. He looked around. Giscard was standing in his alcove, but he ignored him. First things first. He said, "Where's Daniil?" Gladia said, "He has cleaned and dried himself in the robot's quarters, and he has dry clothing. He is surrounded by my household staff, and they have their instructions. I can tell you that no outsider will approach within 50 meters of my establishment in any direction without our all knowing it at once. Giscard is cleaned and dried as well." "Yes, I can see that," said Bailey. He was not concerned with Giscard, only with Daniil. He was relieved that Gladia seemed to accept the necessity of guarding Daniil, and that he would not have to face the complications of explaining the matter. Yet there was one breach in the wall of security, and a note of querulousness entered in his voice as he said, "Why did you leave him, Gladia? With you gone, there was no human being in the house to stop the approach of a band of outside robots. Daniil could have been taken by force." "Nonsense," said Gladia with spirit. "We were not gone long, and Dr. Fastoff had been informed. Many of his robots had joined mine, and he could be on the spot in minutes if needed. And I'd like to see any band of outside robots withstand him." "Have you seen Daniil since you returned, Gladia?" "Of course. He's safe, I tell you." "Thank you." Bailey relaxed and closed his eyes. Oddly enough, he thought, it wasn't so bad. Of course it wasn't. He had survived, hadn't he? When he thought that, something inside himself grinned and was happy. He had survived, hadn't he? He opened his eyes and said, "How did you find me, Gladia?" "It was Giscard. They had come here, both of them, and Giscard explained the situation to me quickly. I set right about securing Daniil, but he wouldn't budge until I had promised to order Giscard out after you. He was very eloquent. His responses with respect to you are very intense, Elijah. Daniil remained behind, of course. It made him very unhappy, but Giscard insisted that I order him to stay at the very top of my voice. You must have given Giscard some mighty strict orders. Then we got in touch with Dr. Fastoff, and after that we took my personal airfoil." Bailey shook his head wearily. "You should not have come along, Gladia. Your place was here, making sure Daniil was safe." Gladia's face twisted into scorn. "And leave you dying in the storm, for all we knew? Or being taken up by Dr. Fastoff's enemies? I have a little holograph of myself letting that happen. No, Elijah. I might have been needed to keep the other robots away from you if they had gotten to you first. I may not be much good in most ways, but any Solarian can handle a mob of robots, let me tell you. We're used to it." "But how did you find me?" "It wasn't so terribly hard. Actually, your airfoil wasn't far away, so that we could have walked it, except for the storm. We..." Bailey said, "You mean we had almost made it to Fastoff's?" "Yes," said Gladia. "Either your airfoil, in being damaged, wasn't damaged sufficiently to force you to a standstill sooner, or Giscard's skill kept it going for longer than the Vandals had anticipated, which is a good thing. If you had come down closer to the Institute, they might have gotten you all. Anyway, we took my airfoil to where yours had come down. Giscard knew where it was, of course, and we got out."
"And you got all wet, didn't you, Gladia?"
"Not a bit," she replied. "I had a large rain shade and a light sphere, too. My shoes got muddy and my feet got a little damp because I didn't have time to spray on latex, but there's no harm in that. Anyway, we were back at your airfoil less than half an hour after Giscard and Daniil had left you, and of course you weren't there."
"I had tried..." began Bailey.
"Yes, we know. I thought they, the others, had taken you away because Giscard said you were being followed. But Giscard found your handkerchief about 50 meters from the airfoil, and he said that you must have wandered off in that direction. Giscard said it was an illogical thing to do, but that human beings were often illogical, so that we should search for you. So we looked, both of us, using the light sphere. But it was he found you. He said he saw the infrared glimmer of your body heat at the base of the tree, and we brought you back." Bailey said with a spark of annoyance,
"Why was my leaving an illogical thing to do?"
"He didn't say, Elijah. Do you wish to ask him?" She gestured toward Giscard. Bailey said,
"Giscard, what's this?"
Giscard's impassivity was disrupted at once, and his eyes focused on Bailey. He said, "I felt that you had exposed yourself to the storm unnecessarily. If you had waited, we would have brought you here sooner."
"The other robots might have gotten to me first."
"They did, but you had sent them away, sir."
How do you know that?
There were many robotic footprints around the doors on either side, sir, but there was no sign of dampness within the airfoil, as there would have been if wet arms had reached in to lift you out. I judged you would not have gotten out of the airfoil of your own accord in order to join them, sir. And having sent them away, you need not have feared they would return very quickly, since it was Daniil they were after, by your own estimate of the situation, and not you. In addition, you might have been certain that I would have been back quickly. Bailey muttered,
I reasoned precisely in that manner, but I felt that confusing the issue might help further. I did what seemed best to me, and you did find me, even so.
Yes, sir.
Bailey said, But why bring me here? If we were close to Gladia's establishment, we were just as close, perhaps closer, to Dr. Fastolf's.
Not quite, sir. This residence was somewhat closer, and I judged from the urgency of your orders that every moment counted in securing Daniil's safety. Daniil concurred in this, though he was most reluctant to leave you. Once he was here, I felt you would want to be here too, so that you could, if you desired, assure yourself of his safety firsthand.
Bailey nodded and said grumpily, he was still annoyed at that remark concerning his illogicality, You did well, Giscard.
Gladia said, Is it important that you see Dr. Fastolf, Elijah? I can have him summoned here, or you can view him trimensionally.
Bailey leaned back in his chair again. He had leisure to realize that his thought processes were blunted and that he was very tired. It would do him no good to face Fastolf now. He said, No, I'll see him tomorrow after breakfast. Time enough. And then I think I'll be seeing this man, Keldon Amadiro, the head of the Robotics Institute, and the high official, what do you call him? The chairman. He will be there, too, I suppose.
You look terribly tired, Elijah, said Gladia. Of course, we don't have those microorganisms, those germs and viruses that you have on Earth, and you've been cleaned out, so you won't get any of the diseases they have all over your planet, but you're clearly tired.
Bailey thought, After all that, no cold, no flu, no pneumonia? There was something to being on a spacer world at that. He said, I admit I'm tired, but that can be cured by a bit of rest.
Are you hungry? It's dinner time.
Bailey made a face. I don't feel like eating.
I'm not sure that's wise. You don't want a heavy meal, perhaps, but how about some hot soup? It will do you good.
Bailey felt the urge to smile. She might be Solarian, but given the proper circumstances, she sounded exactly like an Earthwoman. He suspected that this would be true of Aurorans as well. There are some things that differences in culture don't touch. He said, Do you have soup available? I don't want to be a problem.
How can you be a problem? I have a staff, not a large one, as on Solaria, but enough to prepare any reasonable item of food on short order. Now, you just sit there and tell me what kind of soup you would like. It will all be taken care of.
Bailey couldn't resist. Chicken soup?
Of course. Then, innocently, Just what I would have suggested, and with lumps of chicken so that it will be substantial.
The bowl was put before him with surprising speed. He said, Aren't you going to eat, Gladio?
I've eaten already while you were being bathed and treated.
Treated?
Only routine biochemical adjustment, Elijah. You had been rather psychic damaged, and we wanted no repercussions. Do eat.
Bailey lifted an experimental spoonful to his lips. It was not bad chicken soup, though it had the queer tendency of Auroran food to be rather spicier than Bailey would prefer, or perhaps it was prepared with different spices than those he was used to. He remembered his mother suddenly, a sharp thrust of memory that made her appear younger than he himself was right now. He remembered her standing over him when he rebelled at eating his nice soup. She would say to him, Come, Lige, this is real chicken and very expensive. Even the spacers don't have anything better. And they didn't. He called to her in his mind across the years. They don't, Mom.
Really?
If he could trust memory and allow for the power of youthful taste buds, his mother's chicken soup, when it wasn't dulled by repetition, was far superior. He sipped again and again, and when he finished, he muttered in a shamefaced way, Would there be a little more?
As much as you want, Elijah.
Just a little more. Gladia said to him as he was finishing,
Elijah, this meeting tomorrow morning.
Yes, Gladia.
Does it mean that your investigation is over? Do you know what happened to Jander?
Bailey said judiciously, I have an idea as to what might have happened to Jander. I don't think I can necessarily persuade anyone that I am right.
Then why are you having the conference?
It's not my idea, Gladia. It's Master Roboticist Amadiro's idea. He objects to the investigation, and he's going to try to have me sent back to Earth.
Is he the one who tampered with your airfoil and tried to have his robots take Daniil?
I think he is.
Well, can't he be tried and convicted and punished for that?
He certainly could, said Bailey feelingly, except for the very small problem that I can't prove it.
And can he do all that and get away with it and stop the investigation, too?
I'm afraid he has a good chance of being able to do so. As he himself says, people who don't expect justice don't have to suffer disappointment.
But he mustn't. You mustn't let him. You've got to complete your investigation and find out the truth. Bailey sighed.
What if I can't find out the truth? Or what if I can but can't make people listen to me?
You can find out the truth, and you can make people listen to you.
You have a touching faith in me, Gladia. Still, if the Auroran World Legislature wants to send me back and orders the investigation ended, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do about it.
Surely you won't be willing to go back with nothing accomplished.
Of course I won't. It's worse than just accomplishing nothing, Gladia. I'll go back with my career ruined and with Earth's future destroyed.
Then don't let them do that, Elijah.
And he said, Jehoshaphat, Gladia, I'm going to try not to, but I can't lift a planet with my bare hands. You can't ask me for miracles.
Gladia nodded, and eyes downcast, put her fist to her mouth, sitting there motionlessly, as though in thought. It took a while for Bailey to realize that she was weeping soundlessly.
68. Bailey stood up quickly and walked around the table to her. He noted absently and with some annoyance that his legs were trembling and that there was a tick in the muscle of his right thigh.
Gladia, he said urgently, don't cry.
Don't bother, Elijah, she whispered. It will pass.
He stood helplessly at her side, reaching out to her, yet hesitating. I'm not touching you, he said. I don't think I had better do so, but...
Oh, touch me, touch me. I'm not all that fond of my body, and I won't catch anything from you. I'm not what I used to be.
So Bailey reached out and touched her elbow and stroked it very slightly and clumsily with his fingertips. I'll do what I can tomorrow, Gladia, he said. I'll give it my very best try. She rose at that, turned toward him, and said,
Oh, Elijah.
Automatically, scarcely knowing what he was doing, Bailey held out his arms. And just as automatically, she walked into them, and he was holding her while her head cradled against his chest. He held her as lightly as he could, waiting for her to realize that she was embracing an Earthman. She had undoubtedly embraced a humaniform robot, but he had been no Earthman. She sniffed loudly and spoke while her mouth was half obscured in Bailey's shirt. She said,
It isn't fair. It's because I'm a Solarian. No one really cares what happened to Jander, and they would if I were an Auroran. It just boils down to prejudice and politics.
Bailey thought, Spacers are people. This is exactly what Jesse would say in a similar situation. And if it were Grimaianus who was holding Gladia, he'd say exactly what I'll say, if I knew what I would say. And then he said, That's not entirely so. I'm sure Dr. Fastoff cares what happened to Jander.
No, he doesn't. Not really. He just wants to have his way in the legislature. And that Amadeiro wants to have his way. And either one would trade Jander for his way.
I promise you, Gladia, I won't trade Jander for anything.
No.
If they tell you that you can go back to Earth with your career saved and no penalty for your world, provided you forget all about Jander, what would you do? There's no use setting up hypothetical situations that can't possibly come to pass. They're not going to give me anything in return for abandoning Jander. They're just going to try to send me back with nothing at all except ruin for me and my world. But if they were to let me, I would get the man who destroyed Jander and see to it that he was adequately punished.
What do you mean, if they were to let you? Make them let you.
Bailey smiled bitterly. If you think Aurorans pay no attention to you because you're a Solarian, imagine how little you would get if you were from Earth, as I am. He held her closer, forgetting he was from Earth, even as he said the word. But I'll try, Gladia. It's no use raising hopes, but I don't have a completely empty hand. I'll try.
His voice trailed off. You keep saying you'll try, but how?
She pushed away from him a bit to look up into his face. Bailey said, bewildered, Why, I may...
find the murderer?
Whatever. Gladia, please, I must sit down.
He reached out for the table, leaning on it. She said, What is it, Elijah?
I've had a difficult day, obviously, and I haven't quite recovered it, I think.
You'd better go to bed, then.
To tell the truth, Gladia, I would like to.
She released him, her face full of concern and with no further room in it for tears. She lifted her arm and made a rapid motion, and he was, it seemed to him, surrounded by robots at once. And when he was in bed, eventually, and the last robot had left him, he found himself staring up at darkness. He could not tell whether it was still raining outside or whether some feeble lightning flashes were still making their last sleepy sparks. But he knew he heard no thunder. He drew a deep breath and thought, Now, what is it I have promised, Gladia? What will happen tomorrow? Last act, failure. And as Bailey drifted into the borderland of sleep, he thought of that unbelievable flash of illumination that had come before sleep. 69. Twice before it had happened. Once the night before, when, as now, he was falling asleep, and once earlier this evening, when he had slipped into unconsciousness beneath the tree in the storm. Each time, something had occurred to him, some enlightenment that had unmystified the problem as the lightning had undarkened the night, and it had stayed with him as briefly as the lightning had. What was it? Would it come to him again? This time, he tried consciously to seize it, to catch the elusive truth. Or was it the elusive illusion? Was it the slipping away of conscious reason and the coming of attractive nonsense that one couldn't analyze properly in the absence of a properly thinking brain? The search for whatever it was, however, slid slowly away. It would no more come on call than a unicorn would in a world in which unicorns did not exist. It was easier to think of Gladia and of how she had felt. There had been the direct touch of the silkiness of her blouse, but beneath it were the small and delicate arms, the smooth back. Would he have dared to kiss her if his legs had not begun to buckle beneath him? Or would that have been going too far? He heard his breath exhale in a soft snore, and as always that embarrassed him. He flogged himself awake and thought of Gladia again. Before he left, surely, but not if he could gain nothing for Henriette. Would that be payment for services rend? He heard the soft snore again, and cared less this time. Gladia. He had never thought he would see her again, let alone touch her, let alone hold her. Hold her. And he had no way of telling at what point he passed from thought to dream. He was holding her again, as before, but there was no blouse, and her skin was warm and soft, and his hand moved slowly down the slope of shoulder blade and down the hidden ridges of her ribs. There was a total aura of reality about it. All of his senses were engaged. He smelled her hair, and his lips tasted the faint, faint salt of her skin. And now somehow they were no longer standing. Had they lain down, or were they lying down from the start? And what had happened to the light? He felt the mattress beneath him and the cover over him, darkness. And she was still in his arms, and her body was bare. He was shocked awake. Gladia? Rising inflection, disbelieving. Shh, Elijah. She placed the fingers of one hand gently on his lips. Don't say anything. She might as well have asked him to stop the current of his blood. He said, What are you doing? She said, Don't you know what I'm doing? I'm in bed with you. But why?
Because I want to. Her body moved against his. She pinched the top of his night garment, and the seam that held it together fell apart. Don't move, Elijah. You're tired, and I don't want you to wear yourself out further.
Elijah felt a warmth stirring within him. He decided not to protect Gladia against herself. He said, I'm not that tired, Gladia.
No, she said sharply. Rest. I want you to rest. Don't move.
Her mouth was on his, as though intent on forcing him to keep quiet. He relaxed, and the small thought flitted past him that he was following orders, that he was tired and was willing to be done to rather than to do, and tinged with shame. It occurred to him that it rather diluted his guilt. I couldn't help it, he heard himself say. She made me. Jehoshaphat, how cowardly, how unbearably demeaning. But those thoughts washed away, too. Somehow there was soft music in the air, and the temperature had risen a bit.
The cover had vanished, and so had his nightclothes. He felt his head moved into the cradle of her arms and pressed against softness. With a detached surprise, he knew from her position that the softness was her left breast, and that it was centered, contrastingly, with its nipple hard against his lips. Softly, she was singing to the music, a sleepily joyful tune he did not recognize. She rocked gently back and forth, and her fingertips grazed his chin and neck. He relaxed, content to do nothing, to let her initiate and carry through every activity. When she moved his arms, he did not resist and let them rest wherever she placed them. He did not help, and when he did respond with heightened excitement and climax, it was only out of helplessness to do otherwise. She seemed tireless, and he did not want her to stop. Aside from the sensuality of sexual response, he felt again what he had felt earlier, the total luxury of the infant's passivity. And finally, he could respond no more, and it seemed she could do no more. And she lay with her head in the hollow where his left shoulder met his chest, and her left arm lay across his ribs, her fingers stroking the short curling hairs tenderly. He seemed to hear her murmuring, "Thank you, thank you." For what, he wondered. He was scarcely conscious of her now, for this utterly soft end of a hard day was as soporific as the fabled Nepenthe, and he could feel himself slipping away, as though his fingertips were relaxing from the edge of the cliff of harsh reality, in order that he might drop through the soft clouds of gathering sleep into the slowly swaying ocean of dreams. And as he did so, what had not come on call came of itself. For the third time, the curtain was lifted, and all the events since he had left Earth shuffled once more into hard focus. Again, it was all clear. He struggled to speak, to hear the words he needed to hear, to fix them and make them part of his thought processes. But though he clutched at them with every tendril of his mind, they slipped past and through and were gone. So that, in this respect, Bailey's second day on Aurora ended very much as his first had. Chapter 17. The Chairman. 70. When Bailey opened his eyes, it was to find sunlight streaming through the window, and he welcomed it. To his still sleepy surprise, he welcomed it. It meant the storm was over, and it was as though the storm had never happened. Sunlight, when viewed only as an alternative to the smooth, soft, warm, controlled light of the cities, could only be considered harsh and uncertain, but compared with the storm, and it was the promise of peace itself. Everything, Bailey thought, is relative, and he knew he would never think of sunshine as entirely evil again. Partner Elijah? Daniil was standing at the side of the bed. A little behind him stood Giscard. Bailey's long face dissolved in a rare smile of pure pleasure. He held out his hands, one to each. Jehoshaphat, men. And he was totally unaware at the moment of any inappropriateness in the word. When I last saw you two together, I wasn't in the least sure I would ever see either of you again. Surely, said Daniil softly, none of us would have been harmed under any circumstances. With the sunlight coming in, I see that, said Bailey. But last night I felt as though the storm would kill me, and I was certain you were in deadly danger, Daniil. It even seemed possible that Giscard might be damaged in some way, trying to defend me against overwhelming odds. Melodramatic, I admit, but I wasn't quite myself, you know.
We were aware of that, sir, said Giscard. That was what made it difficult for us to leave you, despite your urgent order. We trust that this is not a source of displeasure for you at present.
Not at all, Giscard.
And, said Daniil, we also know that you have been well cared for since we left you.
It was only then that Bailey remembered the events of the night before. Gladia.
He looked about in sudden astonishment. She was not anywhere in the room. Had he imagined? No, of course not. That would be impossible. And then he looked at Daniil with a frown, as though suspecting his remark to bear a libidinous character. But no, that would be impossible, too. A robot, however human a form, would not be designed to take lubricious delight in innuendo.
He said, quite well cared for. But what I need at the moment is to be shown to the personal.
We are here, sir, said Giscard, to direct you and help you through the morning. Miss Gladia felt you would be more comfortable with us than with any of her own staff, and she stressed that we were to leave nothing wanting for your comfort. Bailey looked doubtful. How far did she instruct you to go? I feel pretty well now, so I don't have to have anyone wash and dry me. I can take care of myself. She does understand that, I hope.
You need fear no embarrassment, Partner Elijah, said Daniil, with a small smile that, it seemed to Bailey, came at those moments when, in a human being, it might be judged that a feeling of affection would have arisen. We are merely to see to your comfort. If at any time you are most comfortable in privacy, we will wait at some distance.
In that case, Daniil, we're all set. Bailey scrambled out of bed. It pleased him to see that he felt quite steady on his legs. The night's rest and the treatment when he was brought back, whatever it might have been, had done marvels. And Gladia, too.
71. Still nude and just damp enough from his shower to feel thoroughly fresh, Bailey, having brushed his hair, studied the result critically. It seemed natural that he would have breakfast with Gladia, and he wasn't certain how he might be received. It might be best, perhaps, to take the attitude that nothing had happened, and to be guided by her attitude, and somehow he thought it might help if he looked reasonably good, provided that was within the realm of the possible. He made a dissatisfied face at his reflection in the mirror. Daniil, he called.
Yes, Partner Elijah.
Speaking through and around toothpaste, Bailey said,
Those are new clothes you are wearing, it seems.
Not mine originally, Partner Elijah. They had been friend Janders. Bailey's eyebrows climbed.
She let you have Janders?
Miss Gladia did not wish me to be unclothed while waiting for my storm-drenched items to be washed and to dry. Those are ready now, but Miss Gladia says I may keep these.
When did she say that?
This morning, Partner Elijah.
She's awake, then?
Indeed, and you will be joining her at breakfast when you are ready. Bailey's lips tightened. It was odd that, at the moment, he was more concerned with having to face Gladia than, a little later on, the chairman. The matter of the chairman was, after all, in the lap of the fates. He had decided on his strategy, and it would either work or it would not work. As for Gladia, he simply had no strategy. Well, he would have to face her. He said, with as careful an air of indifference as he might manage,
And how is Miss Gladia this morning?
Daniil said, She seems well.
Cheerful, depressed?
Daniil hesitated. It is difficult to judge the inner attitude of a human being. There is nothing in her behavior to indicate internal turmoil. Bailey cast a quick eye on Daniil, and again he wondered if he were referring to the events of last night, and again he dismissed the possibility. Nor did it do any good to study Daniil's face. One could not stare at a robot to guess thoughts from expression, for there were no thoughts in the human sense. He stepped out into the bedroom and looked at the clothes that had been laid out for him, considering them thoughtfully, and wondering if he could put them on without error and without requiring robotic help. The storm and the night were over, and he wanted to assume the mantle of adulthood and independence once again.
He said, What is this?
He held up a long sash covered with an intricately colored arabesque. It is a pajama sash, said Daniil. It is purely ornamental. It passes over the left shoulder and is tied at the right side of the waist. It is traditionally worn at breakfast on some spacer worlds, but is not very popular on Aurora.
Then why should I wear it?
Miss Gladia thought it would become you, Partner Elijah. The method of tying is rather intricate, and I will be glad to help you.
Jehoshaphat, thought Bailey ruefully, she wants me to be pretty. What does she have in mind?
Don't think about it.
Bailey said, Never mind, I'll manage with a simple bow knot. But listen, Daniil, after breakfast I will be going over to Fastolf's, where I will meet with him, with Amadiro, and with the chairman of the legislature. I don't know if there will be any others present.
Yes, Partner Elijah, I am aware of that. I don't think there will be others present.
Well, then, said Bailey, beginning to put on his undergarments and doing it slowly, so as to make no mistake and thus find it unnecessary to appeal for help to Daniil, tell me about the chairman. I know from my reading that he is the nearest thing to an executive officer that there is on Aurora. But I gathered from that same reading that the position is purely honorary. He has no power, I take it.
Daniil said, I am afraid, Partner Elijah.
Giscard interrupted, Sir, I am more aware of the political situation on Aurora than friend Daniil is. I have been in operation for much longer. Would you be willing to have me answer the question? Why, certainly, Giscard. Go ahead.
When the government of Aurora was first set up, sir,
began Giscard in a didactic way, as though an information reel within him were methodically spinning. It was intended that the executive officer fulfill only ceremonial duties. He was to greet dignitaries from other worlds, open all meetings of the legislature, preside over its deliberations, and vote only to break a tie. After the river controversy, however...
Yes, I read about that, said Bailey.
It had been a particularly dull episode in Auroran history, in which impenetrable arguments over the proper division of hydroelectric power had led to the nearest approach to civil war the planet had ever seen.
You needn't go into details.
No, sir, said Giscard.
After the river controversy, however, there was a general determination never to allow controversy to endanger Auroran society again. It has become customary, therefore, to settle all disputes in a private and peaceable manner outside the legislature. When the legislators finally vote, it is in an agreed-upon fashion, so that there is always a large majority on one side or the other. The key figure in the settlement of disputes is the chairman of the legislature. He is held to be above the struggle, and his power, which, although nil in theory, is considerable in practice, only holds as long as he is seen to be so. The chairman, therefore, jealously guards his objectivity, and as long as he succeeds in this, it is he who usually makes the decision that settles any controversy in one direction or another. Bailey said,
You mean that the chairman will listen to me, to Fastoff, and to Amadiro, and then come to a decision?
Possibly. On the other hand, sir, he may remain uncertain and require further testimony, further thought, or both.
And if the chairman does come to a decision, will Amadiro bow to it if it is against him? Or will Fastoff bow if it is against him?
That is not an absolute necessity. There are almost always some who will not accept the chairman's decision, and both Dr. Amadiro and Dr. Fastoff are headstrong and obstinate individuals, if one may judge from their actions. Most of the legislators, however, will go along with the chairman's decision, whatever that might be. Dr. Fastoff or Dr. Amadiro, whichever it may be who will be decided against by the chairman, will then be sure to find himself in a small minority when the vote is taken.
How sure, Giscard?
Almost sure. The chairman's term of office is ordinarily 30 years, with the opportunity for re-election by the legislature for another 30 years. If, however, a vote were to go against the chairman's recommendation, the chairman would be forced to resign forthwith, and there would be a governmental crisis while the legislature tried to find another chairman under conditions of bitter dispute. Few legislators are willing to risk that, and the chance of getting a majority to vote against the chairman, when that is the consequence, is almost nil.
Then, said Bailey ruefully, everything depends on this morning's conference.
That is very likely.
Thank you, Giscard.
Gloomily, Bailey arranged and rearranged his line of thought. It seemed hopeful to him, but he did not have any idea what Amadiro might say or what the chairman might be like. It was Amadiro who had initiated the meeting, and he must feel confident, sure of himself. It was then that Bailey remembered that once again, when he was falling asleep with Gladia in his arms, he had seen, or thought he had seen, or imagined he had seen, the meaning of all the events on Aurora. Everything had seemed clear, obvious, certain. And once more, for the third time, it was gone, as though it had never been. And with that thought, his hopes seemed to go, too. 72. Daniil led Bailey into the room where breakfast was being served. It seemed more intimate than an ordinary dining room. It was small and plain, with no more in the way of furnishings than a table and two chairs. And when Daniil retired, he did not move into a niche. In fact, there were no niches, and for a moment Bailey found himself alone, entirely alone, in the room. That he was not really alone, he was certain. There would be robots on instant call. Still, it was a room for two, a no-robots room. A room, Bailey hesitated at the thought, for lovers. On the table, there were two stacks of pancake-like objects that did not smell like pancakes, but smelled good. Two containers of what looked like melted butter, but might not be, flanked them. There was a pot of the hot drink, which Bailey had tried and had not liked very much, that substituted for coffee. Gladia walked in, dressed in rather prim fashion, and with her hair glistening as though freshly conditioned. She paused a moment, her face wearing a half-smile.
Elijah?
Bailey, caught a little by surprise at the sudden appearance, jumped to his feet.
How are you, Gladia?
He stuttered a bit. She ignored that. She seemed cheerful, carefree. She said,
If you're worried about Daniil not being in sight, don't be. He's completely safe, and he'll stay so. As for us... She came to him, standing close, and put a hand slowly to his cheek, as once, long ago, she had done in Solaria. She laughed lightly. That was all I did then, Elijah. Do you remember? Elijah nodded silently. Did you sleep well, Elijah? Sit down, dear. He sat down. Very well. Thank you, Gladia. He hesitated before deciding not to return the endearment in kind. She said, Don't thank me. I've had my best night's sleep in weeks, and I wouldn't have if I hadn't gotten out of bed after I was sure you were sleeping soundly. If I had stayed as I wanted to, I would have been annoying you before the night was over, and you would not have gotten your rest. He recognized the need for gallantry. There are some things more important than rest, Gladia, he said, but with such formality that she laughed again. Poor Elijah, she said. You're embarrassed. The fact that she recognized that embarrassed him even more. Bailey had been prepared for contrition, disgust, shame, affected indifference, tears, everything but the frankly erotic attitude she had assumed. She said, Well, don't suffer so. You're hungry. You hardly ate last night. Get some calories inside you and you'll feel more carnal. Bailey looked doubtfully at the pancakes that weren't. Gladia said, Oh, you've probably never seen these. They're Solarian delicacies, pachinkas. I had to reprogram my chef before he could make them properly. In the first place, you have to use imported Solarian grain. It won't work with the Auroran varieties. And they're stuffed. Actually, there are 1,000 stuffings you can use, but this is my favorite, and I know you'll like it, too. I won't tell you what's in it, except for chestnut puree and a touch of honey. But try it, and tell me what you think. You can eat it with your fingers, but be careful how you bite into it. She picked one up, holding it daintily between the thumb and middle finger of each hand, then took a small bite, slowly, and licked at the golden semi-liquid filling that flowed out. Bailey imitated her action. The pachinka was hard to the touch, and not too hot to hold. He put one end cautiously in his mouth and found it resisted biting. He put more muscle into it, and the pachinka cracked, and he found the contents flowing over his hands. The bite was too large and too forceful, said Gladia, rushing to him with a napkin. Now look at it. No one eats a pachinka neatly. There's no such thing. You're supposed to wallow in it. Ideally, you're supposed to eat it in the nude, then take a shower. Bailey tried a hesitant lick, and his expression was clear enough. You like it, don't you? Said Gladia. It's delicious, said Bailey, and he bit away at it slowly and gently. It wasn't too sweet, and it seemed to soften and melt in the mouth. It scarcely required swallowing. He ate 3 pachinkas, and it was only shame that kept him from asking for more. He licked at his fingers without urging and eschewed the use of napkins, for he wanted none of it to be wasted on an inanimate object. Dip your fingers and hands in the cleanser, Elijah, and she showed him. The melted butter was a finger bowl, obviously. Bailey did as he was shown and then dried his hands. He sniffed at them, and there was no odor whatever. She said, Are you embarrassed about last night, Elijah? Is that all you feel? What did one say? Bailey wondered. Finally, he nodded. I'm afraid I am, Gladia. It's not all I feel by 20 kilometers or more, but I am embarrassed. Stop and think. I'm an Earthman, and you know that, but for the time being, you're repressing it, and Earthman is only a meaningless, disyllabic sound to you. Last night you were sorry for me, concerned over my problem with the storm, feeling toward me as you would toward a child, and sympathizing with me, perhaps, out of the vulnerability produced in you by your own loss, you came to me. But that feeling will pass. I'm surprised it hasn't passed already. And then you will remember that I am an Earthman, and you will feel ashamed, demeaned, and dirtied. You will hate me for what I have done for you, and I don't want to be hated. I don't want to be hated, Gladia. If he looked as unhappy as he felt, he looked unhappy indeed. She must have thought so, for she reached out to him and stroked his hand. I won't hate you, Elijah. Why should I? You did nothing to me that I can object to. I did it to you, and I'll be glad for the rest of my life that I did. You freed me by a touch 2 years ago, Elijah. And last night you freed me again. I needed to know 2 years ago that I could feel desire. And last night I needed to know that I could feel desire again after Jander. Elijah, stay with me. It would be... He cut her off earnestly. How can that be, Gladia? I must go back to my own world. I have duties and goals there, and you cannot come with me.
You could not live the kind of life that is lived on Earth. You would die of earthly diseases if the crowds and enclosure did not kill you first. Surely you understand.
I understand about Earth,
said Gladia with a sigh. But surely you needn't leave immediately. Before the morning is over, I may be ordered off the planet by the chairman.
You won't be, said Gladia energetically. You won't let yourself be. And if you are, we can go to another spacer world. There are dozens we can choose from. Does Earth mean so much to you that you wouldn't live on a spacer world?
Bailey said, I could be evasive, Gladia, and point out that no other spacer world would let me make my home there permanently, and you know that, so. The greater truth is, though, that even if some spacer world would accept me, Earth means so much to me that I would have to return, even if it meant leaving you.
And never visiting Aurora again? Never seeing me again?
If I could see you again, I would, Bailey said, wishing. Over and over again, believe me. But what's the use of saying so? You know I'm not likely to be invited back, and you know I can't return without an invitation.
Gladia said in a low voice, I don't want to believe that, Elijah.
Bailey said, Gladia, don't make yourself unhappy. Something wonderful happened between us. But there are other wonderful things that will happen to you, too. Many of them, of all kinds, but not the same wonderful thing. Look forward to the others.
She was silent.
Gladia, he said urgently, need anyone know what has happened between us?
She looked up at him, a pained expression on her face. Are you that ashamed?
Of what happened? Certainly not. But even though I am not ashamed, there could be consequences that would be discomforting. The matter would be talked about. Thanks to that hateful hyperwave drama, which included a distorted view of our relationship, we are news. The Earthman and the Solarian woman. If there is the slightest reason to suspect that there is love between us, it will get back to Earth at the speed of hyperspatial drive.
Gladia lifted her eyebrows with a touch of hauteur. And Earth will consider you demeaned? You will have indulged in sex with someone beneath your station?
No, of course not, said Bailey uneasily, for he knew that that would certainly be the view of billions of Earth people. Has it occurred to you that my wife would hear of it? I'm married.
And if she does, what of it?
Bailey took a deep breath. You don't understand. Earth ways are not spacer ways. We have had times in our history when sexual mores were fairly loose, at least in some places and for some classes. This is not one of those times. Earthmen live crowded together, and it takes a Puritan ethic to keep the family system stable under such conditions.
Everyone has one partner, you mean, and no other?
No, said Bailey. To be honest, that's not so, but care is taken to keep irregularities sufficiently quiet so that everyone can...
Pretend they don't know?
Well, yes, but in this case,
it will all be so public that no one could pretend not to know. And your wife will be angry with you and will strike you.
No, she won't strike me, but she will be shamed, which is worse. I will be shamed as well, and so will my son. My social position will suffer, and... Gladia, if you don't understand, you don't understand. But tell me that you will not speak freely of this thing, as Aurorans do.
He was conscious of making a rather miserable show of himself. Gladia said thoughtfully, I do not mean to tease you, Elijah. You have been kind to me, and I would not be unkind to you, but... She threw her arms up hopelessly. Your Earth ways are so nonsensical.
Undoubtedly. Yet I must live with them, as you have lived with Solarian ways.
Yes. Her expression darkened with memory. Then, forgive me, Elijah, really and honestly, I apologize. I want what I can't have, and I take it out on you.
It's all right.
No, it's not all right. Please, Elijah... I must explain something to you. I don't think you understand what happened last night. Will you be all the more embarrassed if I do?
Bailey wondered how Jessie would feel and what she would do if she could hear this conversation. Bailey was quite aware that his mind should be on the confrontation with the chairman that was looming immediately up ahead and not on his own personal marital dilemma. He should be thinking of Earth's danger and not of his wife's. But in actual fact, he was thinking of Jessie. He said, I'll probably be embarrassed, but explain it anyway. Gladia moved her chair, refraining from calling one of her robotic staff to do it for her.
He waited for her nervously, not offering to move it himself. She put her chair immediately next to his, facing it in the other direction, so that she was looking at him directly when she sat down. And as she did so, she put out her small hand and placed it in his, and he felt his own hand press it. "You see," she said, "I no longer fear contact. I'm no longer at the stage where all I can do is brush your cheek for an instant."
"That may be, but this does not affect you, Gladia, does it, as that bare touch did then?"
She nodded. "No, it doesn't affect me that way, but I like it anyway. I think that's an advance, actually. To be turned inside out just by a single moment of touch shows how abnormally I had lived and for how long. Now it is better. May I tell you how? What I have just said is actually prologue."
"Tell me."
"I wish we were in bed and it was dark. I could talk more freely."
"We are sitting up and it is light, Gladia, but I am listening."
"Yes. On Solaria, Elijah, there was no sex to speak of. You know that."
"Yes, I do."
"I experienced none in any real sense. On a few occasions, only a few, my husband approached me out of duty. I won't even describe how that was, but you will believe me when I tell you that looking back on it, it was worse than none."
"I believe you."
"But I knew about sex. I read about it. I discussed it with other women sometimes, all of whom pretended it was a hateful duty that Solarians must undergo. If they had children to the limit of their quota, they always said they were delighted they would never have to deal with sex again."
"Did you believe them?"
"Of course I did. I had never heard anything else. And the few non-Solarian accounts I read were denounced as false distortions. I believed that, too. My husband found some books I had, called them pornography, and had them destroyed. Then, too, you know, people can make themselves believe anything. I think Solarian women believed what they said and really did despise sex. They certainly sounded sincere enough, and it made me feel there was something terribly wrong with me because I had a kind of curiosity about it, and odd feelings I could not understand."
"You did not at that time use robots for relief in any way?"
"No, it didn't occur to me. Or any inanimate object. There were occasional whispers of such things, but with such horror, or pretended horror, that I would never dream of doing anything like that. Of course, I had dreams, and sometimes something that, as I look back on it, must have been incipient orgasms, would wake me. I never understood them, of course, or dared talk of it. I was bitterly ashamed of it, in fact. Worse, I was frightened of the pleasure they brought me. And then, of course, I came to Aurora."
"You told me of that. Sex with Aurorans was unsatisfactory."
"Yes, it made me think that Solarians were right after all. Sex was not like my dreams at all. It was not until gender that I understood. It is not sex that they have on Aurora. It is choreography. Every step of it is dictated by fashion, from the method of approach to the moment of departure. There is nothing unexpected, nothing spontaneous. On Solaria, since there was so little sex, nothing was given or taken. And on Aurora, sex was so stylized that in the end, nothing was given or taken either. Do you understand?"
"I'm not sure, Gladia. Never having experienced sex with an Auroran woman, or for that matter, never having been an Auroran man. But it's not necessary to explain. I have a dim notion of what you mean."
"You're terribly embarrassed, aren't you?"
"Not to the point of being unable to listen."
"But then I met Jander and learned to use him. He was not an Auroran man. His only aim, his only possible aim, was to please me. He gave and I took. And for the first time I experienced sex as it should be experienced. Do you understand that? Can you imagine what it must be like suddenly to know that you are not mad or distorted or perverted or even simply wrong, but to know that you are a woman and have a satisfying sex partner?"
"I think I can imagine that."
"And then, after so short a time, to have it all taken away from me. I thought that was the end. I was doomed. I was never again through centuries of life to have a good sexual relationship again. Not to have had it to start with, and then never to have had it at all, was bad enough. But to get it against all expectation and to have it, then suddenly to lose it and go back to nothing, that was unbearable. You see how important, therefore, last night was."
"But why me, Gladia? Why not someone else?"
"No, Elijah, it had to be you. We came and found you, Giscard and I, and you were helpless, truly helpless. You were not unconscious, but you did not rule your body. You had to be lifted and carried and placed in the car. I was there when you were warmed and treated, bathed and dried, helpless throughout. The robots did it all with marvelous efficiency, intent on caring for you and preventing harm from coming to you, but totally without actual feeling. I, on the other hand, watched, and I felt. Bailey bent his head, gritting his teeth at the thought of his public helplessness. He had luxuriated in it when it had happened, but now he could only feel the disgrace of being observed under such conditions. She went on. I wanted to do it all for you. I resented the robots for reserving for themselves the right to be kind to you and to give. And as I thought of myself doing it, I felt a growing sexual excitement, something I hadn't felt since Jander's death. And it occurred to me then that, in my only successful sex, what I had done was to take. Jander gave whatever I wished, but he never took. He was incapable of taking, since his only pleasure lay in pleasing me. And it never occurred to me to give, because I was brought up with robots and knew they couldn't take. And as I watched, it came to me that I knew only half of sex, and I desperately wanted to experience the other half. But then at the dinner table with me afterward, when you were eating your hot soup, you seemed recovered, you seemed strong. You were strong enough to console me, and because I had had that feeling for you when you were being cared for, I no longer feared your being from Earth, and I was willing to move into your embrace. I wanted it. But even as you held me, I felt a sense of loss, for I was taking again and not giving. And you said to me, Gladia, please, I must sit down. Oh, Elijah, it was the most wonderful thing you could have said to me. Bailey felt himself flush. It embarrassed me hideously at the time, such a confession of weakness. It was just what I wanted. It drove me wild with desire. I forced you to bed and came to you, and for the first time in my life, I gave. I took nothing. And the spell of Jander passed, for I knew that he had not been enough either. It must be possible to take and give both. Elijah, stay with me. Bailey shook his head. Gladia, if I tore my heart in two, it wouldn't change the facts. I cannot remain on Aurora. I must return to Earth. You cannot come to Earth. Elijah, what if I can come to Earth? Why do you say such a foolish thing? Even if you could, I would age quickly and soon be useless to you. In 20 years, 30 at the most, I will be an old man, probably dead, while you will stay as you are for centuries. But that is what I mean, Elijah. On Earth, I will catch your infections, and I will grow old quickly, too. You wouldn't want that. Besides, old age isn't an infection. You will merely grow sick very quickly and die. Gladia, you can find another man. An Auroran? She said it with contempt. You can teach. Now that you know how to take and to give, teach them how to do both as well. If I teach, will they learn? Some will. Surely some will. You have so much time to find the one who will. There is... No, he thought, it is not wise to mention Grimianus now, but perhaps if he comes to her less politely and with a little more determination. She seemed thoughtful. Is it possible? Then looking at Bailey with her gray-blue eyes moist. Oh, Elijah, do you remember anything at all of what happened last night? I must admit, said Bailey a little sadly, that some of it is distressingly hazy. If you remembered, you would not want to leave me. I don't want to leave you as it is, Gladia. It is just that I must. And afterward, she said, you seemed so quietly happy, so rested. I lay nestled on your shoulder and felt your heart beat rapidly at first, then more and more slowly, except when you sat up so suddenly. Do you remember that? Bailey started and leaned a little away from her, gazing into her eyes wildly. No, I don't remember that. What do you mean? What did I do? I told you, you sat up suddenly. Yes, but what else? His heart was beating rapidly now, as rapidly as it must have in the wake of last night's sex. 3 times. Something that had seemed the truth had come to him, but the first 2 times he had been entirely alone. The 3rd time, last night, however, Gladia had been with him. He had had a witness. Gladia said, nothing else, really. I said, what is it, Elijah? But you paid no attention to me. You said, I have it, I have it. You didn't speak clearly, and your eyes were unfocused. It was a little frightening.
Is that all I said? Jehoshaphat, Gladia, didn't I say anything more?
Gladia frowned.
I don't remember. But then you lay back, and I said, don't be frightened, Elijah, don't be frightened. You're safe now.
And I stroked you, and you settled back and fell asleep. And snored. I never heard anyone snore before. But that's what it must have been, from the descriptions.
The thought clearly amused her. Bailey said, listen to me, Gladia. What did I say? I have it. I have it. Did I say what it was I had?
She frowned again. No, I don't remember. Wait, you did say one thing in a very low voice. You said, he was there first.
He was there first, that's what I said?
Yes, I took it for granted that you meant Giscard was there before the other robots, that you were trying to overcome your fears of being taken away, that you were reliving that time in the storm. Yes, that's why I stroked you and said, don't be frightened, Elijah, you're safe now, till you relaxed.
He was there first. He was there first. I won't forget it now. Gladia, thanks for last night. Thanks for talking to me now.
Gladia said, is there something important about you saying that Giscard found you first?
He did, you know that. It can't be that, Gladia. It must be something I don't know, but manage to discover only when my mind is totally relaxed.
But what does it mean, then?
I'm not sure, but if that's what I said, it must mean something. And I have an hour or so to figure it out.
He stood up.
I must leave now.
He had taken a few steps toward the door, but Gladia flew to him and put her arms around him. Wait, Elijah. Bailey hesitated, then lowered his head to kiss her. For a long moment, they clung together. Will I see you again, Elijah?
Bailey said sadly, I can't say. I hope so. And he went off to find Daniil and Giscard so that he could make the necessary preparations for the confrontation about to come.
73. Bailey's sadness persisted as he walked across the long lawn to Fastoff's establishment. The robots walked on either side. Daniil seemed at his ease, but Giscard, faithful to his programming and apparently unable to relax it, maintained his close watch on the surroundings. Bailey said, what is the name of the chairman of the legislature, Daniil? I cannot say, partner Elijah. On the occasions when he has been referred to in my hearing, he has been referred to only as the chairman. He is addressed as Mr. Chairman. Giscard said, his name is Rudolin Horder, sir, but it is never mentioned officially. The title alone is used. That serves to impress continuity on the government. Human holders of the position have individually fixed terms, but the chairman always exists.
And this particular individual chairman, how old is he?
Quite old, sir. 331, said Giscard, who typically had statistics on tap.
In good health?
I know nothing to the contrary, sir.
Any outstanding personal characteristics it might be well for me to be prepared for?
That seemed to stop Giscard. He said after a pause, that is difficult for me to say, sir. He is in his second term. He is considered an efficient chairman who works hard and gets results.
Is he short-tempered, patient, domineering, understanding?
Giscard said, you must judge such things for yourself, sir.
Daniil said, partner Elijah, the chairman is above partisanship. He is just and even-handed by definition. I'm sure of that, muttered Bailey. But definitions are abstract, as is the chairman, while individual chairmen with names are concrete, and many have minds to match.
He shook his head. His own mind, he would swear, had a strong measure of concrete itself.
Having three times thought of something and three times lost it, he was now presented with his own comment at the time of having the thought, and it still didn't help. He was there first.
Who was there first? When? Bailey had no answer.
74. Bailey found Fastoff waiting for him at the door of his establishment, with a robot behind him who seemed most unrobotically restless, as though unable to perform his proper function of greeting a visitor and upset by the fact. But then, one was always reading human motivations and responses into robots.
What was more likely true was no upsettedness, no feeling of any kind, merely a slight oscillation of positronic potentials resulting from the fact that his orders were to greet and inspect all visitors, and he could not quite perform the task without pushing past Fastolf, which he also could not do in the absence of overriding necessity. So he made false starts, one after the other, and that made him seem restless. Bailey found himself staring at the robot absently, and only with difficulty managing to bring his eyes back to Fastolf. He was thinking of robots, but he didn't know why. "I'm glad to see you again, Dr. Fastolf," he said, and thrust his hand forward. After his encounter with Gladia, it was rather difficult to remember that spacers were reluctant to make physical contact with an Earthman. Fastolf hesitated a moment, and then, as manners triumphed over prudence, he took the hand offered him, held it lightly and briefly, and let it go. He said,
"I'm even more delighted to see you, Mr. Bailey. I was quite alarmed over your experience last evening. It was not a particularly bad storm, but to an Earthman it must have seemed overwhelming."
"You know about what happened, then?"
"Daniil and Giscard have brought me fully up to date in that respect. I would have felt better if they had come here directly and eventually brought you here with them, but their decision was based on the fact that Gladia's establishment was closer to the breakdown point of the airfoil, and that your orders had been extremely intense and had placed Daniil's safety ahead of your own. They did not misinterpret you?"
"They did not. I forced them to leave me."
"Was that wise?"
Fastolf led the way indoors and pointed to a chair. Bailey sat down. "It seemed the proper thing to do. We were being pursued."
"So Giscard reported. He also reported that..."
Bailey intervened. "Dr. Fastolf, please. I have very little time, and I have questions that I must ask you."
"Go ahead, please,"
said Fastolf at once with his usual air of unfailing politeness. "It has been suggested that you place your work on brain function above everything else, that you..."
"Let me finish, Mr. Bailey. That I will let nothing stand in my way, that I am totally ruthless, oblivious to any consideration of immorality or evil, would stop at nothing, would excuse everything, all in the name of the importance of my work."
"Yes."
"Who told you this, Mr. Bailey?"
asked Fastolf. "Does it matter?"
"Perhaps not. Besides, it's not difficult to guess. It was my daughter Vasilia, I'm sure of that."
Bailey said, "Perhaps. What I want to know is whether this estimate of your character is correct." Fastolf smiled sadly.
"Do you expect an honest answer from me about my own character? In some ways, the accusations against me are true. I do consider my work the most important matter there is, and I do have the impulse to sacrifice anything and everything to it. I would ignore conventional notions of evil and immorality if these got in my way. The thing is, however, that I don't. I can't bring myself to. And in particular, if I have been accused of killing Jander because that would in some way advance my study of the human brain, I deny it. It is not so. I did not kill Jander."
Bailey said, "You suggested I submit to a psychic probe to get some information that I can't reach otherwise out of my brain. Has it occurred to you that if you submitted to a psychic probe, your innocence could be demonstrated?" Fastolf nodded his head thoughtfully.
"I imagine Vasilia suggested that my failure to offer to submit to one was proof of my guilt. Not so. A psychic probe is dangerous, and I am as nervous about submitting myself to one as you are. Still, I would have done so, despite my fears, were it not for the fact that is what my opponents would most like to have me do. They would argue against any evidence to my innocence, and the psychic probe is not delicate enough an instrument to demonstrate innocence beyond argument. But what they would get, by use of the probe, is information about the theory and design of humaniform robots. That is what they are after, and that is what I am not going to give them."
Bailey said, "Very well. Thank you, Dr. Fastolf." Fastolf said,
"You are welcome. And now, if I may get back to what I was saying, Giscard reported that after you were left alone in the airfoil, you were accosted by strange robots. At least you spoke of strange robots rather disjointedly after you were found unconscious and exposed to the storm."
"The strange robots did accost me, Dr. Fastolf. I managed to deflect them and send them away, but I thought it wise to leave the airfoil rather than await their return. I may not have been thinking clearly when I reached that decision. Giscard said I was not." Fastolf smiled.
"Giscard has a simplistic view of the universe. Have you any idea whose robots they were?"
Bailey moved about restlessly and seemed to find no way of adjusting himself to the seat in a comfortable manner. He said, "Has the chairman arrived yet?"
Nobody will be here momentarily. So will Amadiro, the head of the Institute, whom the robots told me you met yesterday. I'm not sure that was wise. You irritated him.
I had to see him, Dr. Fastoff, and he did not seem irritated.
That is no guide with Amadiro. As a result of what he calls your slanders and your unbearable sullying of professional reputation, he has forced the chairman's hand.
In what way?
It is the chairman's job to encourage the meeting of contending parties and to work for a compromise. If Amadiro wishes to meet with me, the chairman could not, by definition, discourage it, much less forbid it. He must hold the meeting. And if Amadiro can find enough evidence against you, and it is easy to find evidence against an Earthman, that will end the investigation.
Perhaps, Dr. Fastolf, you should not have called on an Earthman to help, considering how vulnerable we are.
Perhaps not, Mr. Bailey, but I could think of nothing else to do. I still can't. So I must leave it up to you to persuade the chairman to our point of view, if you can.
The responsibility is mine, said Bailey glumly.
Entirely yours,
said Fastolf smoothly. Bailey said, Are we four to be the only ones present?
Fastolf said, Actually, we three. The chairman, Amadiro, and myself. We are the two principals and the compromising agent, so to speak. You will be there as a fourth party, Mr. Bailey, only on sufferance. The chairman can order you to leave at will, so I hope you will not do anything to upset him.
I'll try not to, Dr. Fastolf.
For instance, Mr. Bailey, do not offer him your hand, if you will forgive my rudeness.
Bailey felt himself grow warm with retroactive embarrassment at his earlier gesture. I will not.
And be unfailingly polite. Make no angry accusations. Do not insist on statements for which there is no support.
You mean don't try to stampede anyone into betraying himself, Amadiro, for instance?
Yes, do not do so. You will be committing slander, and it will be counterproductive. Therefore, be polite. If the politeness masks an attack, we won't quarrel with that. And try not to speak unless you are spoken to.
Bailey said, How is it, Dr. Fastolf, that you are so full of careful advice now, and yet you never warned me about the dangers of slander earlier?
The fault is indeed mine, said Dr. Fastolf. It was a matter of such basic knowledge to me that it never occurred to me that it had to be explained.
Bailey grunted. Yes, I thought so.
Fastolf raised his head suddenly. I hear an airfoil outside. More than that, I can hear the steps of one of my staff heading for the entrance. I presume the chairman and Amadiro are at hand.
Together? Asked Bailey.
Undoubtedly. You see, Amadiro suggested my establishment as the meeting place, thus granting me the advantage of home ground. He will therefore have the chance of offering, out of apparent politeness, to call for the chairman and bring him here. After all, they must both come here. This will give him a few minutes to talk privately with the chairman and push his point of view.
That is scarcely fair, said Bailey. Could you have stopped that?
I didn't want to. Amadiro takes a calculated risk. He may say something that will irritate the chairman.
Is the chairman particularly irritable by nature?
No more than any chairman in the fifth decade of his term of office. Still, the necessity of strict adherence to protocol, the further necessity of never taking sides, and the actuality of arbitrary power all combine toward making a certain irritability inevitable. And Amadiro is not always wise. His jovial smile, his white teeth, his exuding bonhomie can be extremely irritating when those upon whom he lavishes it are not in a good mood for some reason. But I must go meet them, Mr. Bailey, and supply what I hope will be a more substantial version of charm. Please stay here and don't move from that chair.
Bailey could do nothing but wait now. He thought irrelevantly that he'd been on Aurora for just a bit short of 50 standard hours. Chapter 18. Again, the chairman. 75. The chairman was short, surprisingly short. Amadiro towered over him by nearly 30 centimeters. However, since most of his shortness was in his thighs, the chairman, when all were seated, was not noticeably inferior in height to the others. Indeed, he was thick-set with a massive chest and shoulders, and looked almost overpowering under those conditions. His head was large, too, but his face was lined and marked by age. Nor were its wrinkles the kindly type carved by laughter. They were impressed into his cheeks and forehead, one felt, by the exercise of power. His hair was white and sparse, and he was bald in the spot where the hairs would have met in a whorl. His voice suited him, deep and decisive.
Age had robbed it of some of its timber, perhaps, and lent it a bit of harshness. But in a chairman, Bailey thought, that might help rather than hinder. Fastolf went through the full ritual of greeting, exchanged stroking remarks without meaning, and offered food and drink. Through all of this, no mention was made of the outsider, and no notice was taken of him. It was only when the preliminaries were finished, and when all were seated, that Bailey, a little farther from the center than the others, was introduced. He said, "Mr. Chairman," without holding out his hand. And with an offhand nod, he said, "And of course I have met Dr. Amadiro." Amadiro's smile did not waver at the touch of insolence in Bailey's voice. The chairman, who had not acknowledged Bailey's greeting, placed his hands on each knee, fingers spread apart, and said, "Let us get started, and let us see if we can't make this as brief and as productive as possible. Let me stress first that I wish to get past this matter of the misbehavior, or possible misbehavior, of an Earthman, and strike instantly to the heart of the matter. Nor, in dealing with the heart of the matter, are we speaking of this overblown matter of the robot. Disrupting the activity of a robot is a matter for the civil courts. It can result in a judgment of the infringement of property rights and the inflicting of a penalty of costs, but nothing more than that. What's more, if it should be proved that Dr. Fastolf had rendered the robot, Gender Panel, inoperable, it is a robot who, after all, he helped design, whose construction he supervised, and the ownership of whom he held at the time of the inoperability. No penalty is likely to apply, since a person may do what he likes with his own. What is really at issue is the matter of the exploration and settlement of the galaxy, whether we of Aurora carry it through alone, whether we do it in collaboration with the other spacer worlds, or whether we leave it to Earth. Dr. Amadiro and the globalists favor having Aurora shoulder the burden alone. Dr. Fastolf wishes to leave it to Earth. If we can settle this matter, then the affair of the robot can be left to the civil courts, and the question of the Earthman's behavior will probably become moot, and we can simply get rid of him. Therefore, let me begin by asking whether Dr. Amadiro is prepared to accept Dr. Fastolf's position in order to achieve unity of decision, or whether Dr. Fastolf is prepared to accept Dr. Amadiro's position with the same end in view. He paused and waited. Amadiro said, "I am sorry, Mr. Chairman, but I must insist that Earthmen be confined to their planet and that the galaxy be settled by Aurorans only. I would be willing to compromise, however, to the extent of allowing other spacer worlds to share in the settlement if that would prevent needless strife among us."
"I see," said the chairman. "Will you, Dr. Fastolf, in view of this statement, abandon your position?"
Fastolf said, "Dr. Amadiro's compromise has scarcely anything of substance in it, Mr. Chairman. I'm willing to offer a compromise of greater significance. Why should not the worlds of the galaxy be thrown open to spacers and Earth people alike? The galaxy is large, and there would be room for both. I would be willing to accept such an arrangement."
"No doubt," said Amadiro quickly, "for it is no compromise. The over 8 billion population of Earth is more than half again the population of all the spacer worlds combined. Earth's people are short-lived and are used to replacing their losses quickly. They lack our regard for individual human life. They will swarm over the new worlds at any cost, multiplying like insects, and will preempt the galaxy even while we are making a bare beginning. To offer Earth a supposedly equal chance at the galaxy is to give them the galaxy, and that is not equality. Earth people must be confined to Earth."